Going against the grain. It's stating the obvious to observe that vaccination in the United States is a highly charged subject. But the heat of the controversies, my guest today argues, obscures how vaccination, which has saved many lives when used against deadly illnesses, has become so widespread, including for milder diseases. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with historian Elena Conis about the cultural, political, and social forces that have shaped mass vaccination. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since the turn of the 21st century, there have been scores of controversies over vaccination, from the recall of the rotavirus vaccine, disputes over lawmakers requiring sixth grade girls to get vaccinated against HPV, and the debunked claim that vaccines cause autism. These debates are framed around medical soundness, or lack thereof, of each side. But Elena Conis argues that both overlook the social and cultural forces that always shape public health decisions and have been central to the expansion of mass vaccination. She's assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and is affiliated with the university's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society and the Center for Social Medicine. In her book, Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization, which is published by the University of Chicago Press, Conis traces a social history of vaccination in the U.S. Elena, we'll discuss the longer history of vaccination in this country, but I'd like to start by asking you why vaccination has been particularly controversial over the last 20 years. Why do you think that is?
Vaccines have been controversial, I want to emphasize, from the moment they were first developed or the first vaccine was developed. But as you point out, we seem to be living in a moment of heightened controversy over vaccination ever since the start of the 21st century. And a lot of the attention about this controversy in recent years has been about the concern over the theory that vaccines cause autism. And in fact, what I find is that that's actually only a very small part of the story, that there's actually much more that's been controversial about vaccines really since the late 1990s. One aspect was the growing number of vaccines and the growing number of doses of vaccines for kids. Two was the way that we were adding vaccines to the children's vaccine schedule for diseases that were somewhat different from or perceived as somewhat different from the vaccines that we used to use in the past. Three, there was a big pharmaceutical backlash in the very early 2000s that a lot of people seem to have forgotten about at this point, but that really did color the way the public sees vaccines. There were concerns about autism. There were also concerns about increasing numbers of allergies and learning disabilities generally and autoimmune conditions in children. And a lot of these things colored the way that people began to see vaccines. Also, what I found historically is that in general, when government has kind of increased the force that it uses to ensure broad vaccination of the public, we see a pushback. And this is, I'm just pointing to a general historical pattern. And in the early 21st century, we began adding more vaccines to the schedule, began requiring that more children get vaccinated to enroll in school or daycare, for instance. So with that added enforcement, we also saw some pushback. So there's a whole long list of reasons.
And yet, despite all the controversy, how extensive is vaccination of children in America today?
It's pretty extensive. The thing to remember is that I think today the number of doses that young children are required is something on the order of about 36 doses by the time they enroll in school. And we now routinely vaccinate against somewhere between 10 and 12 diseases. And that is a substantially longer list of infections, a substantially longer list of vaccines and vaccine doses than children of previous generations have ever received.
Well, we're going to be talking in this hour about how vaccines have been regarded in the wider culture and certainly from public health officials and so on, and how that has shifted over time, the changes and why, what has driven those changes. But in kind of looking at medicine through this social lens, social cultural lens, which you do in Vaccination, how do you see the successes of vaccines in public health terms?
Well, there's a very long answer, and maybe there's a shorter answer that I can start with. And one thing is to start with maybe the indisputable fact that through vaccination, we fully eradicated one of the most frightening diseases that humans ever faced, which was smallpox. And we did it through a worldwide, global, coordinated effort that involved the targeted vaccination of people living in places where the disease was still a problem in the 60s and 70s, ensuring that people were vaccinated around those kind of clusters of cases and outbreaks until there was no more smallpox on the face of the earth. So it's true that vaccines, and they kind of form an exception in this case, have given us a tool that's incredibly powerful against infectious disease. At the same time, in this country, and as in some other Western industrialized countries, we've been able to use vaccines to, and vaccination, I'll say, to drive disease rates so low that we consider, for instance, or did consider measles, for instance, eliminated in this country, which means that there were no more quote-unquote indigenous cases happening in the U.S. All the cases were coming from outside of the U.S. We had eliminated the spread of measles within our borders. And really, we're only facing the disease when it was coming from outside. And that is also an incredible accomplishment made possible by vaccines. We also, however, have seen vaccines that perhaps maybe haven't been as successful. The mumps vaccine, for instance, has driven rates of mumps way, way, way down. But mumps vaccine is less effective than some of the other vaccines that we have. And we continue, as a consequence, to see repeated outbreaks of mumps, even in the modern age of really high levels of vaccination against that infection. So we see that the vaccines themselves have been incredibly powerful and capable of incredible accomplishments. But that's not true necessarily across the board for all vaccines or types of vaccines.
I wonder if you could just take us briefly back to the history of the first vaccines in the 19th century through the middle of the 20th century, and what the reception of the vaccines was, both in terms of how they were seen by those involved in public health and then by the general public.
Sure. And I do write and study the United States, but with respect to vaccination, it's impossible to talk about this without talking about how other countries were using vaccines and other related practices to prevent diseases. And the very first vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, is generally credited to an English physician who developed the vaccine in the end of the 18th century. And fairly quickly, that vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, began to be used by European nations to protect the entire population, or if not the entire population, maybe their entire army against smallpox. And as soon as vaccination was used in that way, and even beforehand, and when I say in that way, I mean in a kind of compulsory public health way where entire groups of people, if not entire nations, were being asked to get vaccinated, that very quickly brought on resistance and objection. And one of the examples that many people who like to speak in defense of vaccines like to bring up today is that in 18th and very early 19th century England, there were a lot of people who were opposed to the smallpox vaccine based on quote-unquote irrational fears. And they feared that because the vaccine was made of material from cows, that that meant that they themselves were going to become bovine in some way. And this was one of a number of fears and objections that people had. And one fear and objection was, yes, what did it mean to put material from an animal inside of one's body and not to eat it, but to actually incorporate it into your bloodstream and make it a part of you? But objections also had to do with the fact that governments were asking people to do something when they were in a state of health and they didn't necessarily agree that it was necessary or buy into the grand project of becoming protected as a population from this disease. So early on, we saw resistance based on fear of the vaccines and also objection to the kind of political principles behind vaccination. And over the course of the 19th century, that spread. And it was the real, it was British groups who coined the phrase anti-vaccine later in the 19th century. And these British anti-vaccinationists were largely opposed to compulsory vaccination. They also had fears about the risks that vaccines carried. Sometimes contaminated vaccines could spread diseases like syphilis, for instance. But they were very, very concerned with the fact that policies required people to get vaccinated and not always equitably. So in other words, sometimes, and this happened in France as well, people who lived below a certain income level were forced to get vaccinated at rates that weren't necessarily expected of the wealthy, for example. So these were the main objections of anti-vaccinationists in Europe in the 19th century, and they carried those ideas over to the U.S. in the 19th century, in the later 19th century, when some of our states began experimenting with requiring or making vaccination compulsory as well.
Was there any particular American take to an opposition or a skepticism around vaccines in the late 19th century into the 20th century?
That's interesting. That's a really interesting question. Usually anti-vaccinationism in this country is attributed to a kind of libertarian stand that the folks who objected to vaccination believed that government should have a kind of smaller footprint and shouldn't be reaching so deeply into their personal lives and into their bodies. And even as I talk about this, you can tell that this is not a strictly libertarian view. This is, especially later in the 20th century, it becomes a liberal view as well, and not just about vaccines. So yes, there is a libertarian strand in the U.S. informing how people feel about vaccines and informing vaccine rejections, but it doesn't necessarily look so different from the objections that we're seeing in Europe in the 19th century as well. And the real difference in the United States is that in the 19th century, really up until the 1960s, the U.S. federal government doesn't really get involved in vaccination. This is really a state and sometimes even city or sometimes county affair, that it's very local government that is taking the step to say, okay, we see an outbreak coming. It's time for everybody to get vaccinated. Or maybe we don't see an outbreak coming, but we have a new vaccine, like the diphtheria vaccine. Let's get the entire city's kids vaccinated to make sure that we can do what we can to keep this disease at bay. So that's really happening at such a local level throughout the late 19th and into the early 20th century. And so the vaccine battles tend to be very local at that time as well.
Elena Konis is my guest. She's assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and we're talking about her book, Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then taking this story up through the mid-20th century, how did World War II shift or affect public perceptions around vaccination?
That's a really good question. As I was saying before, prior to the mid-20th century, vaccination was really a kind of local affair. And what happened in World War II was that our federal government took an interest in sponsoring research into vaccines in order to protect our troops. And there was this incredible push to come up with new vaccines to protect soldiers against things like flu, also measles, even mumps. In other words, anything that would spread in a place where people were living in crowded conditions as they were in army barracks and also and some of the war-torn cities of Europe. And so very quickly, we saw a number of new experimental vaccines be developed. And they weren't necessarily all successful, but they laid the groundwork for a couple of things. One is that the public heard a lot about vaccine development during the war and came to believe in the power of vaccines to prevent disease and became accustomed to expecting that vaccines for all kinds of infections were just around the bend. And the other major thing that came out of the war was simply all this new scientific knowledge about how to develop vaccines and really a scientific workforce that had been trained to work in the lab and in the clinic to develop new vaccines. And so it wasn't at all surprising that once the war was over, we entered what some call the golden era of vaccination and had really a number of new vaccines come out in the 50s through the 60s, a greater number of vaccines than had ever been developed before in all of history.
And one hallmark vaccine, if one can call it that, of that period was polio. How was the vaccination for polio regarded by the general public?
The polio vaccine was the vaccine that literally everybody wanted because polio was the one disease, the one infectious disease that continued to affect Americans and continued to cause outbreaks even as all these other infectious diseases were going away. So following the war, late 1940s into the early 50s, there were greater and greater epidemics of polio, really frightening Americans. There was a massive philanthropy. The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which later became the March of Dimes, which was raising money across the country and also at the same time really raising awareness and to some extent really cultivating fear about the disease, although it was in itself a really frightening infection. And what happened was the expectation, as I mentioned before, that a new vaccine was coming was there among the public. The scientific enterprise was poised to begin working on it. There were scientists across the country and in Europe and elsewhere as well who were working on a vaccine. And within fairly short order, by 1954, we had an effective vaccine. And the public just ran out and got it. There was literally no talk of making it compulsory because everybody was so desperate for it and everybody was desperate for the protection that it offered.
So then the period that you focus on in vaccination as marking a kind of new era comes out of the successes of polio. So in the 1960s, the U.S. government, people involved in public health, have a new vision of the role that vaccines can play. What was it? What did they envision, and how did it turn into practical policy?
Yeah, great question. And this, to me, when I look back over our 200-year history of vaccination, this really is a critical turning point. And it builds on the national experience with polio in a couple of key ways. One is that everybody perceived polio as primarily a disease affecting children. And so the perception then followed that, okay, the vaccine was for children, and everybody got their children vaccinated, despite efforts to try to get adults vaccinated as well in the early 1960s. The second thing that polio did was it made us believe that once an infectious disease threat appeared, we could come up with a vaccine and we could use that vaccine widely. And the third thing is that within a fairly short time, largely almost entirely through vaccination, polio starts to disappear. And it within less than a decade in the U.S. is practically close to a non-issue compared to what it had been in the 1940s. And so in the 1960s, after the two polio vaccines are developed, we get a number of other new vaccines developed against measles, against one against mumps, one against rubella. And from this point forward, due to a host of changes going on, what we see is the development of this new era that's marked by kind of four main characteristics. One is the federal government starts to take a bigger, more authoritative role in saying who should get vaccinated against what and when. And the federal government was forced into that role with polio because the public was so desperate for it that President Eisenhower was kind of forced to say, okay, hold on, we're going to allocate federal funds and make sure that everybody who needs access to the vaccine can get access to the vaccine. So following that step with his passage of the Polio Vaccination Assistance Act, what we see afterwards in the 1960s is government kind of defaulting to that role with new vaccines, putting money forward at the federal level to say, okay, states, here are funds, here is support, and also here are guidelines to help you vaccinate your population homogeneously. That really starts in the 1960s. The second thing that starts in the 1960s is that we start to get vaccines against what scientists and epidemiologists and physicians at that time called the quote-unquote mild infections. And they called diseases like measles, mumps, and rubella mild because they were, in comparison to smallpox, polio, and diphtheria, which were all the previous targets of vaccination, they were relatively mild. And that changed the conversation about vaccines. But the other thing that it did was it meant that parents weren't running out to get these vaccines for their children. So increasingly, and this is a third kind of major change of the new era of vaccination, increasingly we started to rely on compulsory vaccination, requiring that children get vaccinated to enroll in school. And this is a real shift from how vaccines had been used before, which were really only made compulsory in the face of epidemics and really of the whole population. But from the 60s on, we began to think of things differently. And there's one more thing that kind of changes in this era, too, which is that, again, thanks in part to our experience with polio, we begin to think that it's possible to eradicate diseases entirely with vaccines. And this mentality that vaccines can be used to completely wipe a disease off the face of the earth takes root in the 1960s and, again, succeeds with smallpox and, to date, not with any other human disease.
What is the logic of making a vaccine compulsory?
The logic of making a vaccine compulsory is it has to do with the term herd immunity, that if you require everybody in a population to get vaccinated, you get high enough protection in that population that there's no way for an infection to take hold. All of our vaccines are not 100% effective, and nor can all of our vaccines be given to 100% of the population. So, you know, even our most effective vaccines might be just a couple of percentage points short of being 100% effective, which leaves a handful of people susceptible. What that means is that if you make a vaccine compulsory, you get enough people vaccinated that any infection that does take hold in an unvaccinated person or in a person whose vaccine didn't, quote, take, that infection can't go anywhere because everybody else is protected. And this was the way that, for instance, 19th century cities endeavored to keep smallpox out of the way. As long as you could force everybody to get vaccinated, smallpox would have no chance of causing an epidemic in your city. And this is also the logic behind the 1960s school vaccination enrollment laws that became so popular in that decade. Again, if we vaccinate enough kids, then these diseases won't spread in schools. And if they don't spread in schools, kids won't bring them back home and they won't spread through our communities as well. And that's pretty much the logic. And the term herd immunity has to do with the fact that your population is a herd. And the way to keep the entire herd immune is to immunize as many of those members of the herd who can be immunized.
Elena Konis is my guest. We'll return with her in a moment.
Your descent slowly.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization, published by the University of Chicago Press. Her name is Elena Conis, and she teaches in UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. So in the 1960s and accelerating in the 1970s, there was building opposition or skepticism about vaccines coming from the social movements of the 60s, coming from the new left, from the feminist movement, from environmentalism. In broad terms, what was the nature of the criticisms leveled by people coming out of those movements?
Those movements are, to me, it was so fascinating to see the connection between the rise of the new left and the social movements of the new left and the beginnings of, you know, the kind of first stirrings of vaccination resistance or hesitancy that grew in the 1980s, 90s, and into the early 21st century. And I think maybe I'll kind of tackle this question by telling an anecdote. When I first started researching vaccination, it was the early 2000s, and I kept coming across this story that people were telling, which was that the quote-unquote anti-vaccine movement all got started with an NBC documentary that was aired on a Washington, D.C. NBC affiliate in 1982. And it was all about the risks of the DPT, the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine, and that this documentary was really irresponsible. It had caused parents to kind of freak out and alarm over the fact that the vaccine might be causing brain damage or even death or permanent disability in their children. And when I went and watched that documentary myself, I was so struck by a couple of things. And one was how gendered the documentary was. There was a female reporter who was behind the documentary and on screen through most of it, and she was interviewing really primarily mothers, and the mothers were sharing their fears about vaccines and the kind of negative reactions that they had seen in their kids. And on the other side of the table were all these male scientists and physicians. And so this was about lay people and experts, but really it was gendered right down the middle. It was about males versus females. And as I listened to the objections and some of the things that the women in the film were saying, I heard things that to me were direct echoes of the women's health movement, which was a kind of a component of second wave feminism in the 1960s and 70s. And what they were saying were things like, I went and looked at the medical literature myself, and I saw that there was a risk of the vaccine, and the doctor never told me about that risk. Or I went and I looked at the package insert for the vaccine, and I saw that there were contraindications for my child, but the doctor never shared that with me. These women were using a kind of discourse that was created by second wave feminism, and specifically women who were part of the women's health movement in the 60s and 70s had said things like doctors weren't listening to them. When they looked at the literature themselves, they found out things about their bodies and the drugs that were being prescribed to them that had been withheld from them. They began to perceive the medical profession as paternalistic and therefore unworthy of their trust. And so the kind of main lesson of that movement for many women was take your health into your own hands. And as these women had children, what I began to see was they began to ask the same kinds of questions about their kids and the drugs, including vaccines, that their children were getting. That's kind of one way in which these movements influence vaccination skepticism. But the other thing that I found was that as I started to read things that vaccine critics were writing and saying in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, I also saw that they were saying something that previous, quote, anti-vaccinationists or vaccine skeptics had never raised because it wasn't an issue. And this is, namely, they were looking at the ingredients in vaccines and they were seeing chemicals and they were seeing ingredients that, as they noted, when those ingredients were contained in other products, like if they were in the food supply or in cigarettes, they would be labeled dangerous. But they saw these very ingredients in vaccines. And so they began to say, why do we have these chemicals in our vaccines? What does it mean to take these chemicals into our bodies? And yes, these vaccines prevent an infection in the short term, but what do we really know about their long-term risks? And some of these authors directly quoted Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and they quoted Rachel Carson saying, look closely. If you don't believe in the course that's laid out for you, question the authorities and find your own way. And also think about long-term consequences and think about the limits of what science can tell us. Science has answers, but there are also many things that science doesn't necessarily yet have the tools to see. And it's worth asking questions about those things as well. So to me, the influence of, in particular, feminism and environmentalism on vaccine discourse was really overwhelming. And there's also so much more that the social movements of the time did to influence people's vaccine beliefs. Just in general, the kind of movement for informed consent in medicine, the patients' rights movements, the disability rights movement, and a whole host of movements that prompted people to question authority in general.
Another thing that seemed to have been a factor in shaping the ways that people saw vaccines has to do with the shifting nature of childhood in that same period. And relating to that as well, a shifting sense of family over a wider sense of community. When you were talking earlier about herd immunity, that's an appeal to the community. And yet, for a lot of people, their focus was much closer to home, so to speak.
Yeah, this is so interesting. So a few things that I noticed in the course of my research have bearing on this issue. One is that when I looked at how the vaccines for, again, quote, mild diseases were promoted in the 1960s and early 70s, I was really struck by, well, one way in which they were promoted was by telling parents that their children could be the best and the brightest. And so these vaccines weren't necessarily about protecting kids from deadly diseases, but there was one article, and I want to remember the quote exactly, that the article promoted vaccines as a way to stop these diseases from taking the edge off of your child's intelligence, that we were creating a generation of the best and brightest, and these vaccines were a way of getting us there. And this was a really different way, subtle but profoundly different way of thinking about what vaccines offered society and what they offered individual children. So on the one hand, we have these vaccines being talked about as a way to make these children, help them reach their kind of optimal potential and help the nation reach its optimal potential as a consequence. We also saw, and this is maybe a tangential point, but I'll mention it here because it just has come to my mind, these vaccines being promoted as a way to help women stay in the workforce. So again, related to second wave feminism, but in a very different way, the mild vaccines were promoted to women as a way of saying, you don't want to take 2, 3, maybe even 4 weeks off of work if Johnny gets the mumps and then, you know, his sisters get it too. You want to be at your job, in the office, or wherever, so make sure your child gets vaccinated and you can stay at work. And so we see vaccines being kind of used in this very different way that is encouraging the family really to think of its own best interests and encouraging parents to think of their children's best interests. And to me, it's always been interesting how in the 21st century, we've turned back to these calls for considering the health of the community and considering the necessity of herd immunity, because that's really out of sync with where we began this era of vaccination, with really promises that vaccines were the best for your individual child. And this is to say nothing of the norms embedded in our healthcare system, which throughout the 20th century and really into the 21st really sends the message that health is your individual responsibility, and it's up to you to keep yourself and your family healthy. And so to call for herd immunity when we have a long tradition of telling people to take personal responsibility for their health, it's a little out of sync, to put it mildly.
Tell us about the controversy around the hepatitis B vaccine and the social context in which it all blew up.
Sure. And maybe I'll start by saying that The hepatitis B vaccine became interesting to me about 10, 11 years ago now when we first started talking about HPV vaccination. And the HPV vaccine was the first one, was approved for use in this country in 2006 and very quickly started to become mandated or attempted to become mandated in about 24 states across the U.S. And controversies blew up in those states. The public wanted nothing to do with compulsory HPV vaccination for young girls. And at the time, those laws targeted young girls.
And this is for the sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah, and HPV is sexually transmitted. And what a number of public health officials and experts said at the time was, this is kind of strange. We HPV vaccine is a way of preventing cervical cancer. Yes, it's a sexually transmitted infection, but we already have another vaccine, the hepatitis B vaccine, that does pretty much the same thing. It's one, can be sexually transmitted and often is, and two, can be linked to cancer. So if everybody has agreed to get their kids vaccinated against hepatitis B, why is HPV so different? And one of the obvious ways in which it's different is that HPV was being given just to sixth grade girls. Hepatitis B, ultimately, as of the mid-90s, was being given to all infants in the U.S. But what I found as I looked back at the history of hepatitis B was that that wasn't the initial vision of hepatitis B, that when the first vaccine was developed, which was in 1981, it was a very different vaccine from the vaccine we had now. It was made from the plasma of donors who had hepatitis B antigens in their blood. And it was considered an incredible kind of scientific accomplishment. To the creation of this vaccine was considered an incredible accomplishment. But it also was perceived as a vaccine that would be given to very few people and just the people who were most at risk of hepatitis B. And to make a very long story short, there was a long kind of convoluted path to go from that moment in 1981 where we had a plasma-based vaccine that was just going to be given to, and I'll quote or an excerpt from the list of people, I think it was gay men, injection drug users, sex workers, and some immigrants. It was a very long convoluted path from that policy and that vaccine to the policies that we ended up with by the late 1990s that required hepatitis B vaccine for every single kid, every single newborn in the U.S. And a very short list of the changes that affected and that gave shape to the policies that we have today is the fact that we came up with a new hepatitis B vaccine that was genetically engineered and came to be seen as the kind of carrying the hopes and the promises of genetically engineered pharmaceuticals. We also had an AIDS epidemic that broke out and that cultivated fear around hepatitis B as a, quote, cousin of AIDS. And we also had a president, President Clinton, who kind of took it upon himself to really promote the cause of vaccination from the White House and to put in place new federal programs that ended up giving states really incentives to start requiring vaccines for all kids. And the policies that we ultimately got for hepatitis B and that we still have in place today were an outcome of President Clinton's real championing of childhood vaccination.
Elena Conis is my guest. She's assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and we're talking about her book, Vaccine Nation. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in the 2000s, the kind of skepticism that you argue is nothing new in the United States about vaccines really intensified over a number of different vaccines. There was a vaccine recall. There were a number of things happening, but probably the key one was controversy around one vaccine causing autism, something that scientists came out and said, no, there is no link here whatsoever. And around all of the controversy to do with this vaccine and other vaccines also swirled all sorts of assumptions about privileged upper middle class parents who were making the rest of the community sick by keeping their children from being vaccinated. You trace in your book the kind of shift over a half a century or longer of support for vaccination, popular support, and then growing skepticism. But at the same time, actually very widespread levels of vaccination. So the skepticism, how it actually translated into the number of children vaccinated, is itself a real question. Why do you think there was at least that intensity of the controversy at that time, even if, in practical terms, the vast majority of American children remain vaccinated?
Wow, that's so many good questions, and I have lots to say in response. So let me take it sort of piece by piece. And one thing that I really want to emphasize is that when I first started researching vaccination, the very first thing that I was struck by was that, yes, we seem to be at a moment of intense controversy about vaccination, but we also were at a moment of incredible, historically unprecedented acceptance of vaccination. We have the most vaccinated generation of children, really, in all of history. And this refers to a couple of things. We're achieving really high levels of vaccination to this day. I think last year, this is the 2015-2016 school year, I think is the most recent data available, upwards of, it was close to 95% of kids are receiving MMR vaccine, DTaP vaccine, even varicella vaccine. And that's a really high level of vaccination, especially considering that the other way in which today's generation of kids is so highly vaccinated is the fact that they're receiving more vaccines against more infections than any generation previously had. So to ignore that accomplishment is to really miss something big. We're focusing on resistance and skepticism and missing the bigger picture, which is the remarkable acceptance of vaccination in this country. We also, in our conversations about vaccination, tend to conflate anti-vaccination and also personal belief exemptions, which have recently been made illegal or in California, but still exist in lots of other states. Personal belief exemptions, these are exemptions that parents can file with schools to say, I am not going to vaccinate my children for either medical, well, not medical or religious, but philosophical reasons. And these go up in the early 21st century, but they go up at the same time that the vaccine schedule expands. And I think that there's a great misconception out there that the fact that personal belief exemptions has gone up means that there are all these people, including, as you mentioned, the upper class, privileged, wealthy, educated families who are not vaccinating their kids. The assumption is that they're not vaccinating their kids against anything. But in fact, personal belief exemptions tend to be used most often for HPV, like we were talking about before. And I believe the other two are flu and chickenpox vaccine. So we're really talking about a small number of vaccines out of the total, and personal belief exemptions being filed for at least one vaccine, but not necessarily all vaccines. So we have, to some extent, a misperception of the scale and scope of vaccination resistance or rejection. The other thing that I found really interesting about the kind of last two decades of vaccination resistance is that right now we seem to think that it's all about autism, and we tend to trace this back to a single physician, a man named Andrew Wakefield, who published a paper in the medical journal The Lancet in 1998. And his paper purported to have found a link between the MMR vaccine, that's the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and autism. But later, I think it was about 11 years later, this article was retracted by The Lancet. It was found that he had fabricated data and been paid to produce the results that he did, and had serious conflicts of interest, and he was stripped of his medical license. All of that aside, when I went back and looked closely at what had happened historically, I found that when his paper came out in 1998, the American media ignored it. Parents were not paying attention to it. Even if you went back and looked on, you know, use the Internet Wayback Machine, you won't see people talking about Wakefield. You will, however, already see them worried about vaccines. And if you go prior to 1998, you'll see them already worried about autism. Autism was already on the rise. It becomes first floated as a feared consequence of vaccination that I found in the early 1980s. So it's around for a very long time. Wakefield, I believe, is responding to that longstanding fear with his 1998 paper. But again, that paper doesn't really get attention in the U.S. until the early 2000s. And it gets attention at that time alongside a host of other vaccine risks that are all explored. But what happens from, say, about 2002 to 2006, 2007, during that five-year period, all of these other vaccine worries tend to get kind of swept aside, ignored. These are worries about neurological consequences of hepatitis B vaccine, for instance, and other things like that. They all get kind of overwhelmed by the story about autism. And on the one hand, this is because autism cases are rising just absolutely dramatically in the United States. But the other reason, and this is kind of a more complicated reason, so I'll just state it in brief, although I talk about it at greater length in my book, is that it's so roundly and solidly disproven by the evidence that the public health establishment has essentially an interest in seeing this reason kept out because it can be so easily proven wrong. All these studies say there's no connection. The media, however, has an interest in keeping the autism debate alive for very different reasons, and that is because there are no other good explanations for autism. It makes for incredibly dramatic reporting. Our media universe at that point is fracturing, and there's ever more competition for listeners, for eyes on the page or on the screen. And so there is this kind of rush for really dramatic stories. And what more dramatic than a number of parents saying, my child got vaccinated and now look at her. She can't communicate. She can't make eye contact. She can't go to school. And I know it's the vaccine. So there are so many reasons why the autism story comes to dominate, but it really is distracting us from all of these other concerns about vaccines and worries about vaccines, many of which really persist to the present day. And if you listen closely and carefully to the full spectrum of what the vaccine hesitant, not just the anti-vaccine, but the vaccine hesitant are saying, you will see really, I would say, reasonable concerns about where we're going with vaccination, what the end game is, how many vaccines will we ultimately want to require for our children, and what is this doing to us in ways that maybe we haven't yet been able to perceive with our current scientific and epidemiological methods. Those are questions that people have asked in lots of other realms and which some of the vaccine hesitant are asking. And these are not the quote-unquote irrational questions that the vaccine hesitant are so frequently accused of asking.
Where do you think it's going? Obviously, you're not a soothsayer, but you spoke earlier, and you write in your book, about an impulse to eradicate illnesses. And while it was successful with smallpox, it was successful with polio, it hasn't been successful with other illnesses. And you trace in your book how there have been different explanations, cultural explanations for why that is per decade. In the 60s, it was different than in the 80s or 90s. How do you understand that push to eradicate diseases, both very serious, which obviously vaccines can save lives, and then milder illnesses? What do you kind of understand as the logic and the direction this is headed in, and how do you understand it in these broader social, cultural, political terms?
Yeah, so historians are famous for really not liking to talk about the future. And I have to confess that the only way I know to talk about the future is by looking to the past. But one of the things that I like about history is how it makes aspects of the present kind of pop out in stark relief. And one of the things that you just brought up was, yes, every generation or every decade really has its sort of explanation of who's to blame for currently persistent vaccine-preventable diseases. And yes, in the 1960s, I found that it was, quote-unquote, the poor and the lack of our social policies or the inadequacy of our social policies to treat the poor the same way they treated the middle class and the rich. And today, in the 2010s, we're blaming somebody entirely differently. We tend to be blaming the upper class, well-educated, privileged, but able to kind of homeschool, private schools, you know, whatever, to get around vaccine requirements. And these preoccupations, I think, say more about our society and our culture at a given moment in time than they say about how effective or ineffective our vaccines are. And right now, I think we're dealing with dramatic social inequality that's influencing how we talk about vaccines. In other words, we're not at the moment talking as much about people who still lack vaccines because it's hard to take their kids to the doctor, or because, you know, healthcare, access to healthcare, or simply time off from work is such a tremendous barrier. And instead, we're talking about people who have such an incredible privilege that they can essentially buy out of a public good. And to me, that's a distraction from the other ways in which wealth and privilege allow people to buy out of public goods, like public transportation, public schools, on down the list. And so vaccination is this kind of handy distraction from these broader issues. But to ask where we're going, I can't say I have any prediction about what we'll be chalking up under vaccination or, you know, vaccine-preventable disease outbreaks to in the 2020s. I do know that when you look to the past, it's really striking how much technology has done to improve vaccination acceptance and uptake. And one of the best examples of this are the combined vaccines that were created in the 1940s through the 1970s, vaccines that combined, for example, protection against diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, and later mumps, measles, and rubella. Those combined vaccines essentially got the public to buy into vaccines, for example, like the mumps vaccine, that might not otherwise have been that easy a sell. And so I think that, you know, to talk, this isn't necessarily science fiction, although it may sound that way to some, you know, to talk about a patch that could administer 100 vaccines within a matter of minutes of application to the arm in, you know, 10 years or so, that would probably dramatically change the way we think about, object to, promote vaccination. But absent knowing the full scale of where the technology is going, and of course where we're going as a society, it's really, really hard to say where our vaccination conversations will go in the future too.
Well, for a look at where vaccinations have been and where they've taken us in the past, I've been speaking this hour with the author of Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, and you can find a link to it at our website, againstthegrain.org. Elena Conis teaches at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. She's affiliated with the university's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and she's working on a book about the history of the pesticide DDT. Elena, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sasha. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.